Welcome to Taking the Rams by the Horns, a podcast that takes current affairs out of current affairs. This is a podcast in partnership with Sowetan Live. I'm your host, Rams Mabote. Now, Taking the Rams by the Horns has been nominated for the 2024 ABVA Awards in the comedy section. That's not a joke. You do not need to be more convinced to use my services at your next event as your MC or facilitator. I will save your events from your boring speakers, especially your CEO or keynote speaker politician. Send your request now on rems at remsmabote.com. South Africa is alive with possibilities. I mean, who would have imagined a former president in jail? A sitting president sleeping on cash, literally. A cabinet minister visiting a common prisoner in jail. Or even the post office operating, even when they have nothing to do.
Can you confirm that delivery performance has dropped?
Welcome to the new Sowetan Live podcast called Taking the Rams by the Horns with me, Rams Mabote. Each week, I will be taking a lighter look at very serious topics that half the time drive you up the wall. This podcast will use humor to take no prisoners, have no holy cows, and cook a whole lot of sacrificial lambs.
You speak of tribal differences. I don't know if you understand the difference between tribal and national. We regard ourselves as a Tswana nation and not a tribe. We have always had... We are a nation, let me start that way. And we have always had our own homeland.
It is 1976. Not now, silly. Then, 1976. And the apartheid government needs some magic to deal with the problematic children of South Africa who are making too much noise while the elders are chilling lazily on Robben Island and poverty-stricken villages like London and Moscow. To distract the attention of the world from this new renaissance led by black students, the apartheid government finally implements its Bantu Homeland Citizens Act of 1970. That year, they established the Bantustan of Transkei in the Eastern Cape. The next year, 1977, Buputatswana in the northwest, in the now northwest, followed. 2 years later, it was Venda in Limpopo, and then one Ciskei in 1981, also in the Eastern Cape. Through the stroke of the pen, the white rulers of this country had invented black independent states. But no one paid attention. The majority of the black population understood these mostly non-economic parcels of land as exactly what they were planned to be, enclaves to move black people from white South Africa and divide them according to the ethnic groups. Four homelands and later four other so-called self-governing states, KwaZulu, Gazankulu, Lebowa, and Qwaqwa. At least Qwaqwa produced Hlaudi Motsoeneng. But I digress. All these states, as they were called, even though they were only recognized by apartheid South Africa, the Grand Master, and very few rogue states around the world, were bestowed with leaders the citizens did not choose. Some were cantankerous, others stupid and not educated, and others comical. In Buputatswana, however, the apartheid rulers gave the reins to a man who was to prove to be an enigma. While the apartheid bosses no doubt loved Mangosuthu Buthelezi of KwaZulu for his belligerence and brawn against liberation parties, Lucas Manyani Mangupe of Buputatswana, and the love of his bosses for his intoxicating ways of managing to pawn the idea of an independent state to his people and making them believe there was something like Israel in Africa.
Ya
Although, like his contemporaries in the other homelands, Mangope was a dictator. He had a seductive turn of phrase. He was self-deprecating, funny, and erudite. And to his credit, under him, Bophuthatswana was to become the most economically successful of the homelands. This endeared him to the so-called citizen, some of whom, even today, 30 years later, since the abolishment of homelands, still harbor a secret love for the man they called Tautona. Could one of these be my guest on this episode? Is Opa Sekgalwe a closet lover of Lucas Mangope? Why else would someone decide to write a biography of this man 7 years after his passing on and 30 years after his fiefdom was brought to a halt? Disclaimer, according to my late uncle on my mother's side, we were related to Mangope. I doubted this until both men died, and then I buried the idea. It's been on out for about 2 months now, and it's flying off the shelves. Lucas Mangope, a lie. He might as well have called it Lucas Mangope, a lie. All of 284 pages that trace the man, his beginnings, and his ending. Sekgalwe dumela.
Dumela raitso.
O siame.
No, tsotlhe di aperitsi ya magona
bona. Ke lebogela go bona, man. I've been excited seeing this book out there. Like, I've been waiting for this moment. Like, yeah. Why? Why?
Well, there are several reasons as to why I decided to document this story. First and foremost, it has to do with the confusion I grew up with around the legacy of Kgosi Mangope. Coming from Motswedi, his home village, I was exposed to a lot of discussions around him, especially around 1994, both in my own household and outside my household. So in my own household, he was held in high esteem. I suspect that has to do with the fact that my grandfather worked for him at some point. So he was obviously proud of him. And remember, at the time, he was president of Bophuthatswana. So there's some level of prestige that comes with working for a president among commoners. And I use the word commoners because Kgosi Mangope was also our traditional leader in that part of the world. Now, he was revered in my household, as I say, because of all of the things that people believed he did for the people of Bophuthatswana, you know, the infrastructure expansion and all of that.
And we're going to speak a lot about that later.
Yes. Yeah? But each time I stepped out onto the streets, going to school, going to the shops, there was a discord in that other people were saying something totally opposed to what I had at home, that he was a dictator, he
people
was
like
corrupt.
Me.
Yes. And others would say, whereas at home, they said, no, people like Nelson Mandela, who had just came out of prison and was leading the ANC's campaign for that watershed election, that Mandela was coming to bring about freedom and equality between blacks and whites. At home, they were saying, no, this Mandela is a former jailbird. You know, he's coming to take away all those good things.
So,
exactly. Yeah. So those contradictions stayed with me for a very, very long time. And I recall around about then, I had this cousin who was much older than us, who liked playing a record of Amaqabane and Blondie McKenney.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
You know, and it had some of the songs had unkind things to say about Kgosi Mangope. And I recall my grandmother used to get very upset at hearing those kind of things. But then you grow older, and later on in life, you have an independent mind of your own. You can read on your own. You are studying journalism and all of that. And you interact with all sorts of people at university in Gauteng. And they bring to you all sorts of perspectives. And you realize that perhaps my grandparents may have been politically apathetic or the Bophuthatswana propaganda was just too strong. But then you see all these other views about him and you read and you find out that actually there is a story here that could be told. Which brings me to my next point that as a consumer of local political literature, I've always felt that our literature tends to focus more on those who were at the forefront of the liberation struggle. Because as I always say, people tend to gravitate towards heroes.
Yeah.
But I believe that to tell the story of our transition from apartheid to where we are now, all of the role players, irrespective of whether they were heroes or villains, Their stories are important to tell, especially if we are to bequeath all of this body of work to those who will come after us so that they know where we come from or what other people had to go through to get to where we are today.
Because in fairness, he has been written out of history, right?
Yeah.
It's as if he never existed.
Exactly.
You have to know him to remember that he existed. But generally, it's not spoken about. There's nothing about this man out there.
Yes. You tend to hear about him around the time of elections.
Yeah.
When journalists go to the ground to interact with voters on yeah. what their expectations and aspirations are. And that's when you get this element of nostalgia with people who are frustrated with how the current government has fared over the last 30 years, tend to look back, you know, to say, no, perhaps where we come from was better, especially in that part of the country
yeah.
that is now the Northwest. A lot of that sentiment comes up during election.
He was a smart guy. I mean, he went to St. Peter's, a very prestigious school. I mean, some of the people who went there were Eskia Mphahlele, who was his yeah. classmate at some yeah. point, I think. There were people like Andrew Mlangeni, Duma Noge. These are luminaries of the ANC, yeah. SACP, Oliver Tambo. But he didn't follow the route yeah. they followed politically.
Yes, he took his own path against the grain, and they tried to pull him back, you know. That day, Mlangeni was telling me that in the early 90s, they used to have reunions of former St. Peter's, learners. And then some within that grouping would be averse to having him invited to that kind of gathering because of the path that he took. And when he explained why he went that route many years ago, he said he was opposed to the armed struggle. He felt that there was another way to get to the promised land, which was contradictory considering the path that he himself took yes. when he accepted the so-called independence,
yeah.
which I call a euphemism for the stripping of black people of their South African citizenship to have them divided and ruled by the white ruling elites of Pretoria.
Mm.
Yeah.
And yet, though, he was not in the ilk of Mpepu in Venda. He was not in the level of, well, you know, Mangosuthu Buthelezi would have been also eloquent, but Lucas Manyane Mangope did come across as a very smart, educated, erudite man.
Yes, he was sophisticated. He was smart. He was intelligent, and he had the gift to persuade people to see things from his perspective, yes. at least those that followed him.
Yeah.
And those were attributes that you did not find among some of his contemporaries at the time.
Mm.
And some of that, it shone through the vision that he had, however ill-advised,
yeah.
for that particular part of the country, and how that transformed into development for that small piece of the country.
Why do you think, and I don't know if it's in the book, I must say I've been frantically going through it, why do you think that, the current leaders of all the homelands and the self-governing states, this is the one that seemingly seems to be vilified most?
Look, I suspect it has to do with the stance he took in the early 90s when everybody else was rallying behind the idea of a united South Africa, equal rights, multiracial elections and all of that. If you recall, at CODESA, he refused to sign that pact that everybody else was signing yeah. to throw their weight behind the idea of a united South Africa. And he even took the side of right-wingers who rejected that whole thing.
Well, they once came to rescue him
yes,
you know,
yes.
against his own course. Force, right?
You know, he proclaimed that Buputazwane would remain independent for the next 100 years. And
exactly. I remember those words.
And he had options, right? So when the going got tough, he said, rather than reincorporating into South Africa, I would rather, as a first option, retain our independence. And if at all it fails, I would rather we merge with Botswana, because he argued that Buputazwana and Botswana were always one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he harked back to the time of the scramble for Africa to say this border between South Africa and Botswana was imposed, and in so doing, it parted into two. One nation.
One people.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was another option that he felt could be explored as opposed to reincorporating. So I think all of those things rubbed the ANC up the wrong way, such that he was dealt with harshly, you know, humiliated.
We're going to get to the commission at some point.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you could have written about Brian Molefe. But let's not go there. Why do you think the apartheid government chose him to lead that part? You know, because these guys were chosen arbitrarily. I have never found what motivated, how they were picked.
So you will see in the book that long before independence, there were different levels in the hierarchy of governance back then. You know, you had tribal offices where you had several chiefs running the show. And then you had regional authorities made up of different chiefs from different areas. And then you had territorial authorities made up of different regions. Now, you will see his father, who passed away in 1958, he had been chosen because of his good relations with the government of the day. He had been identified to run the Zirast tribal traditional authority, right? But then he passes away. And that role should have gone to Abraham Muilwa, who was the chief of Dinukana.
Yeah.
And it didn't go to him, although he enjoyed some sort of paramount status as a chief in that area. It didn't go to him because of his relations with the ANC. And the government did not like
now
the guys.
Now things
like
fall
that
into place. Because yes. I've heard about the Muilas.
Yes.
Okay.
So with his father passing away, he then took over, controversially as well, because if you look at this family, they were not supposed to be the chiefs in Motswedi. His father was a regent holding the fort for a gentleman called Rakhaje, who was banished from Motswedi because of his relations with the ANC. But he was the heir who should have led that area. Anyway, he takes over from his father, and then he works his way up the ranks. Initially, he was deputizing a certain gentleman called Tidimani Pilani, who is the father of Nyalala Pilani in Muruleng.
In Muruleng, yes.
Bakhatla Bakhafel. So at some point, he then outfoxed Pilani to be in pole position as the man who was going to take the people of that part of the country to independence.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. And then, you know, in spite of everything, right? I mean, homelands were vilified by a lot of people, and I include myself.
Yeah.
But then this guy goes on a crazy period of development. I mean,
two
big stadiums, more than 100 schools, a university, pop studios. I mean, it was described at some point as better than the CNN studios,
that's
pop studios. You know, two major hotels, and then, of course, Sun City Resort. Yeah. Who was this guy? I mean, I don't get it.
You know, he was, even when you read his speeches on Independence Day, the speeches he delivered on Independence Day and the following day when he was installed as president of Botswana in the parliament of that homeland, he was alive to the reality that Botswana was going to be a pariah of some sort, rejected by nations of the world as a puppet of Pretoria. But he was determined to work hard to get it recognized as an independent state. And part of that process involved developing infrastructure and, you know, developing the people there, creating a vibrant economy there, so as to persuade the world to start seeing Botswana as independent. And he didn't even start there, by the way. He started with repealing laws that were applicable in South Africa, racial laws, and allowing for things like, black people to be able to marry white people in Botswana, whereas in South Africa
it was a sin. It was a crime and a sin.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he changed some of those laws. If you look at the constitution of Botswana, it almost mirrors what we have now as a constitution, because it has a Bill of Rights which guarantees all sorts of rights and freedoms that you find in our own constitution.
Was the freedom of speech, I doubt.
It was there on paper.
Okay.
But in reality,
as long as you okay things, your speech was okay.
Yes, yes. But they had the death penalty. I suppose it's one thing that stands out that you don't find in our current regime. But all of those efforts were an attempt on his part to cut the umbilical cord, if I may say so, between Botswana and South Africa, and say we are a different nation. Look, people here enjoy the rights they don't enjoy across the border. And he went across the world. He addressed the UN. He addressed the parliament in the UK, trying to get support to get that country, recognized. But also because of those, you know, infrastructural advancements, Pretoria was then able to hold Botswana up as a success story.
Yeah, like you see, this thing's working. We told you this thing is good for people.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So when critics came from across the seas to come and observe exactly what is happening here, they would be taken to Botswana and say, no, look, apartheid is working. I don't know what...
I mean, listen to you. He created education to produce people like you, right? I mean, clearly he did something right. Who was behind him? He surely would have had advisors behind him to say, this is how to do this. And I'm not taking anything away from him as a smart person.
Yeah. He tended to surround himself with people in the know. I mean, if you look at the education system in Botswana, there's a certain Dr. Lekela. I think he was based in the Northern Cape. There was a commission called the Lekela Commission, which was entrusted with the responsibility of revising the education system as part of a move from Bantu Education, which was the authority at the time. And if you look at what the Lekela Commission did, it covered everything from early childhood development all the way to the university. So all those schools that were built there, the early development centers that were built there until UNIBO, including even manpower, they were informed by the findings of the Lekela Commission. So he tended to surround himself with people like that. But there were other people who were seconded from South Africa. For instance, at independence, there was military top brass from the SADF who were seconded to Botswana to go and establish a defense force there. And they stayed there for as long as that homeland was in existence. And in other areas as well, senior civil servants from South Africa were seconded to Botswana to go and help establish the public service there. So that was his modus operandi. He didn't go on his own feelings or his own thoughts. He tended to attract people who knew better and then assisted him to get his way.
But then in the process of all these amazing developments that, you know, he pulled out, the human nature came in, right?
Yeah.
Money was siphoned. I mean, the stories of him and this Liat, is it Liat or late?
Yeah, Liat, Shabtai Kalmanovich.
Yeah.
So Shabtai was a very controversial figure who came from Israel. Of course, he ended up staying in Russia. But he ran away from that part of the world after he was found out to have been a double agent who spied for both the Russian intelligence and the Israeli intelligence. And then even before he came to South Africa, he was involved in blood diamond trade in Sierra Leone. So he ends up here in South Africa. He establishes a construction company based in Sandton. And then it does a lot of business with the government of Botswana. And it's alleged that he enjoyed a very huge influence over Khosi Mangope, or he exercised influence over Khosi Mangope such that, you know, he benefited from shady tenders.
Yeah.
So he would, there would be a need to build a stadium or a housing development or a shopping mall somewhere in Harankua. And then his company would get the job without going on tender.
Sounds like things that happened today, right?
Exactly. And if the job was, for instance, 30 million rand, he would charge 45 million rand, right? And then he takes the 15, calling it management fee. Then he subcontracts the job to the real contractors who can do the job. And it's alleged that in that entire transaction, Khosi Mangope would get kickbacks from him.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's what led to the commission, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, although he calls the commission the Square Ear Commission, what's the word?
A witch hunt.
A witch hunt.
Yeah.
But the reality is that it was a search for alleged monies that were stolen during his rule.
Exactly. And in fact, although he called it a witch hunt, it was proven that indeed those things did happen, because on the strength of the scathing findings of that commission, the government of Pupo Molefe was able to press charges of fraud and corruption against him, and they succeeded. And it's important to stress this point. This was not in an apartheid court. This was in a post-apartheid court in 1998. And the significance of this is that...
I covered that commission for the Sunday Times.
Yes.
I was there every day.
Of course. The significance of underscoring the point that this was not an apartheid court is that at that point, we had a constitution which guaranteed even accused persons' rights and freedoms that they did not enjoy under apartheid. So if you go to section 35 subsection 4 of the constitution, you will find those rights there. You know, the right to be tried in an open court, the right to
representation,
to representation of your own choice, and all of that. But most importantly, the right to appeal a decision. So he didn't appeal that decision after he was convicted and sentenced to concurrent 2-year jail terms with an option of a fine. And he paid.
He slept on the wrist.
Exactly.
Right?
He then stayed out of jail by paying that 2 million rand fine. So that is just to say, irrespective of how he viewed the commission, in a court of law, the standard is high. In the commission, they decide on the basis of a balance of probabilities. In a criminal court, it had to be proven beyond reasonable doubt.
And it was hard. There was no paper trail.
Exactly. You know?
So I can't remember the year, but somewhere between 1986 and 87, we go to a funeral in the then Buputatswana to bury a comrade who lived in Soweto, but his home was in. And you know, everything goes on, but there's police escort there. I mean, they know we're not supposed to be there, but you know, they're just around us, not interfering. Until at the end, when the coffin was lowered and we started singing Nkosi Sikelel' iAfrika. And this one, supposed senior cop, comes to us and says, Anunlopela. One of the guys says the national anthem. And he says, Molefatsin Lama.
You wanted you to sing Lefatsin Lama Raro.
So, you know, and this leads me to the next point that everything said, he was a ruthless dictator. I mean, his police and defense forces were feared.
Yeah, they were. In fact, in parts of the book, I reflect on that to say, you know, those who were, you know, opposed to the homeland system were often, you know, dealt with harshly. You know, dissent was not tolerated in Buputatswana. It was met with brute force. And I refer to some of the examples. There is the one story of a young man who was 16 years of age at the time. He ran into two Buputatswana police officers at the local shop in Zeras. And then there was a scuffle between them. They took him away. And then that was the last time he was seen alive, because then a few minutes later, he was on the side of the road with a wound on his forehead and he had died. But when you check what the scuffle was all about, the scuffle was because he was either wearing a T-shirt that had ANC brand colors or the T-shirt had a Mandela face on across the chest. That was just
that
enough
was
to take them off.
Yeah,
that was the extent of...
But such things, I mean, brutality against own people, those who supported the struggle, corruption in the homelands, were not unique to Buputatswana, And it would appear to me that a lot of these guys, unlike him, got away scot-free, you know, in New South Africa.
Well, there were a lot of deals made around about 93-94. Even with him, they tried. You know, they dangled carrots in his face to say, look, if you allow the people of Buputatswana to vote, you allow for political activity in Buputatswana, we could give you a very serious role in the what was to be the original GNU.
Yeah.
You know, he could have played a big role there, but he was not persuaded. And the fact that he stayed, you know, set in his ways about where he stood with regards to the new South Africa, I think it rubbed certain people in the ANC up the wrong way, such that Mandela would have choice words for him. Like, he called him a Hitler, you know, something like that, to put the point across that we despise this guy for the stance he is taking. He's holding us back. We want to move.
Yeah.
You know, everybody else is in the fold. It's only him who's standing on the other side. So he had to
and feel the wrath. And yet, in KwaZulu, the other fellow was also not wanting to come in. In fact, he was threatening violence.
Yes,
Mangope was not necessarily threatening violence. He just did not want to be part of this.
He didn't want to be part of this. But the difference between them is that at the death, Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi convicted, which is why...
But it took last minute.
Exactly, last minute. That's why they had to append his party's detail on the readily printed ballot. As I say, the fact that he changed his mind worked to his advantage, unlike Jose Mangope, such that he even got to play a role in the GNU.
Yeah.
Of course, that was part of what is called sunset clauses, to say any party that participates and scores above 5% of the vote, it will play some role in the GNU.
Which the UCDP did not.
It did not. The first time they contested national and provincial elections in post-apartheid South Africa was in 1999.
And then in 1988, suffered a coup d'etat led by Rocky
Malemane
Metsi, right?
Yes.
It was ill-fated. I mean, it was abortive. It didn't last a day, I think.
Yes.
He was rescued by PWA.
Exactly.
It was another moment that was surreal. Because again, those of us who did not want to recognize Botswana as a country, to then suffer a coup sounded so strange.
Yeah, it was a very interesting time. You know, you can just imagine this. You are sleeping at your home, and there's a bit of controversy there because Piri, there's a gentleman called Timothy Piri.
Yeah.
He was the soldier that planned the final details of the coup, working closely with Rocky Malebane Metsi. And when I spoke to him, he told me when they broke into his house in the early hours of February 10, 1988, to capture him and hold him hostage at the stadium next to the estate that was the residence of the executive in Mopu Tazwan. He claims that he found Jose Mangope in his bedroom with an unidentified red-haired white woman. He didn't describe the woman beyond that. But that's the controversy I'm referring to, that he was captured in those circumstances. And they captured him in his bed clothes, obviously, barefoot, and they prodded him with R4 rifles, led him to the stadium, along with a few other ministers who were there at the time and other people who were top brass in the military. And then, as you say, they were held there for 15 or so hours.
And in those hours, they kept on saying he must relinquish, and he kept on saying no. Guns pointed at him. You know, he even mentions that they brought in, you know, gallons of petrol, and they threatened to burn him.
Exactly.
And he said, "Pisambana." You know, I'm not giving up my...
They had prepared letters of resignation for him and the ministers. And the deal was that they must sign those letters, essentially saying, "We relinquish power." But he refused. And when he refused, they threatened to either shoot him execution style or set him alight, douse him with that flammable substance and torch him. But even under those circumstances, he still refused. He said to them, "Over my dead body will this happen."
Yeah, as we spoke, you know, the negotiation started and he refused to participate, right?
Yes.
Although he lost his homeland or his power in 1994, when, you know, we ushered in democracy, he remained convinced that the ANC was never the right party to govern. I mean, what did he say to you when you went to see him in his old age about what South Africa had turned out to be?
You know,
I mean, I know that he was
a
bit aged then by the time you went to see him.
Yes. I might have, you know, left it too late, you know, to work on this project, because as I say in the book, By the time I got those two opportunities to sit down with him, it was clear to me that I wasn't going to get anything out of him, because he was already, you know, of ripe age, and he had lost his mind.
It was a bit senile. It happens with age,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Yes, he had dementia. So trying to speak to him, you didn't.
Why did
much.
It take you a decade, by the way, to complete this book?
You know, a lot of things happened. There was a lot of frustration with the research and with publishing companies. You know, each time you knock on a publisher's door and they say, I don't want this thing.
I know.
I would get dejected and I would abandon it for two or so years, then go back to my study, read a few lines and say, but there's something here. And that's what kept me going. And I think on the sixth attempt with a different publisher, my current publisher, that's when I got the green light.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did he die a bitter man? Did he feel his nation betrayed him?
He died a bitter man on many fronts. You know, firstly, he never recovered from, you know, the collapse of his empire in 1994, and which is why you see in 1995, right in the middle of the Square Commission of Inquiry, he launches a political comeback with a rebranded United Christian Democratic Party. And hell-bent at taking the fight to the front door of the ANC. He believed he still had some support, and he thought that in 1999 he would win by a landslide, at least in the Northwest, and reclaim the keys to Haruna. But that never happened. In fact, he only got 3 out of 33 seats that were there for the taking, which were enough to have him topple the Democratic Party, the DA's predecessor, as the official opposition in the Northwest for 2 successive terms. But that's as far as it went. From then on, it went downhill such that his party couldn't even register for the last election. I think it's as good as dead. For the last 2 terms, it didn't even feature anywhere in parliament. But the bitterness was not just about what transpired in 1994. He was deposed from his position as president of the UCDP post-1999. There was strife within the party, with people accusing him of being a dictator, which is very interesting because people had been saying that about his role.
Exactly.
And
why didn't they listen to us?
You know, the funny thing is that the UCDP had a constitution in terms of which every 3 years it had to go to Congress. And at Congress, that's where they had to elect leadership.
Yeah.
But each time an election was closer during Congress, his loyalists would rise from the floor and say, guys, I'm happy with José Mangumpe's leadership. I don't think that we should go to an election. And a huge sum of them would say, yeah, we agree. And he would never say anything. He would just accept it. And that created resentment among those who wanted to challenge him for the leadership position. And then in the long run, things came to a head, and then they rebelled against him. When they did, he fired them, both from their roles in parliament and their membership of the party. But they went to court and they won. On their return, they took him to task, and he stormed out of a disciplinary hearing because he couldn't understand that these guys that I brought in are taking me on.
Yes.
And that was when he retired from politics for good, and he was very bitter. One of the people that were taking him to task, there was his own sibling, his only surviving sibling, Mayor Ipuse Nditsitelo. And up to the point he passed away, they didn't see eye to eye. On one occasion, he sent her packing when she visited him in Motsweding.
Wow. So, what will he be most remembered as? A visionary, a dictator, a corrupt man, a sellout?
You know,
all of the above.
All of the above, because his legacy is a very divisive subject. You know, you find passionate arguments about how good he was as a politician, as a leader, but you find just as much passionate arguments about how he was the opposite. And I've been monitoring the feedback to the book on social media and all of that. You find those kind of people who are saying, no, you are besmirching this man's good name.
I can imagine.
You are disparaging him and all. I expect that from those who are related to him, his family and all of that. But the public, you get that sentiment. But at the same time, you get those who are saying, no, this is just the truth. These are things that happened. We know they happened, you know.
See, if somebody went to the international school in Mafikeng, it would be hard to convince them that things were not okay.
Exactly.
And they got the best education. Everything seemed like a euphoria of some sort.
Exactly.
Right?
You find those kind of people. But you also find people who went to UNIBO or people who worked for Bob TV or Radio Mabatu or people who worked in the government who say, we see all of these things, but the truth is that system was diabolic.
Yeah. He stopped broadcasts.
Yeah.
He would walk into a broadcast and stop things because he's not happy about what's happening, right? Where do we get the book?
The book is available in stores. I don't know if I can mention the names of the...
Why not?
The stores, yes. Exclusive Books.
It's the list we owe you.
Bargain Books. And you can even order online from platforms like Takealot. It is out there. It's taking a life of its own. It's been very interesting to see how people react to it. I would not have thought that people would react this way. I mean, for the longest time, I held on to it in my computer, you know, stewing over how it's going to be received.
Yeah.
I remember how nervous I was on the eve of the launch. But looking back, it wasn't so bad. And I was worrying over nothing.
So the reception has been fairly okay?
It's been very good. I've read a few reviews, one in the City Press, the other one was published in the Mail and Guardian, written by an academic in the Free State, and it's very encouraging. Mm. It's very encouraging, and I couldn't be happier.
Any feedback from his family? Any feedback from the general, his son?
Well, as you would expect, Cosima Ngope's family related to him differently than all of us. To us, he was a politician, he was a traditional leader, he was this and that. To them, he was a father, he was a grandfather, he was an uncle and all of that. So you expect that they will not be happy with certain things.
Yeah.
But what keeps me, or what helps me sleep at night is the fact that in putting together this work, I relied on three key principles that underpin the work of journalism. Truth, accuracy and fairness. And I think I did very well in that regard, even if I say so myself.
I can tell you on the truth, but mate, the kind of research you put into this book, I don't know how you kept a job and kept on doing this kind of research. Just like writing a thesis for a PhD. Yeah. It's hugely researched.
Which explains why it took longer, I suppose.
Ah, bloody excuse. Ogbo Segane, author of Lucas Mangope, Alive. Thank you very much, mate.
Thank you.
Well done. We wait for the next project.
Thank you so much.
Hopefully the person is not dead by the time you write about this. Thank you for listening to this episode of Taking the Rams by the Horns. Download the My Sowetan app and listen to more of my podcasts. We are also on Spotify. Follow us on X at Rams by the Horns and at Sowetan Live. Please send your comments to me via email on rams@ramsmabote.com. Let me know what you think of the podcast. From me, Rems Mabote, good night and God bless.